Welcome once again to our program, our series, Understanding the Bible, a Catholic approach to interpreting sacred scripture. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus here at St. Patrick's, and was pastor for 20 years. St. Patrick's is at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the two streets. Our guest, as usual, is Ron Eldred, who is a teacher of Bible and history at John Paul II Catholic High, and has done some wonderful research for us in this program. The Vatican Council quoted in its document on the sacred scriptures, "To be ignorant of the scriptures is to be ignorant of Christ." And that's why we're spending a lot of time on this greatest book ever in the world. The Old and the New Testament are the Biblos, or the Bible, that God has inspired in the Old Testament and the New Testament. We're going to do just a little quick review of where we've been. This is, I believe, our 10th series. And Ron, welcome once again. Would you like to do just a little review of what we've been saying about the Bible up to this time?
Well, the last program we started to take a look at a comparison of Catholic and Protestant Bibles. So we'll review a little bit of that at the beginning of this session and then get into some new material.
And it's one of the most common questions I ever got as a parish priest. What is the difference and why is there a difference between Catholic and Protestant Bibles? So you're right on target with the material.
Well, Catholic Bibles contain all of the Old Testament books that have been traditionally accepted by Christians since the time of Jesus. They contain seven more Old Testament books for a total of 46 than do Protestant Bibles, which contains 39. You might get some versions, Catholic versions, that would have 45 books. But the reason is that sometimes they combine Lamentations and Jeremiah, if I recall right. Those are the two that are combined in some translations.
Sure.
Catholics call these seven books deuterocanonical, which means the second canon. The deuterocanonical books include Tobit.
Now, if you would, go through slowly, because I think people are interested in what these books are that we have as Catholics and the Protestants do not have.
Okay, well, Tobit, sometimes called Tobias in some translations, Judith, Wisdom, Sirach, Baruch, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, and parts of Esther and Daniel.
Okay, I always tell people Catholic Bible is heavier than the Protestant Bible because we've got seven more books.
Yes. When examining the question of what books were originally included in the Old Testament canon, it is important to note that some of the books of the Bible have been known by more than one name. For example, Sirach is also known as Ecclesiasticus. First and Second Chronicles sometimes is called First and Second Paralipomenon. It's kind of hard to get out.
It's a Greek word.
Ezra and Nehemiah as 1 and 2 Esdras, 1 and 2 Samuel, with 1 and 2 Kings. Some Bibles you'll pick up, there'll be 1, 2, 3, and 4 Kings.
Instead of 2 Samuel.
Instead of 2 Samuel, right. In other words, there'll be 1 and 2 Samuel, which would be 1 and 2 Kings, and then there'd be 1 and 2 Kings, which would be 3 and 4 Kings in some of those versions.
So what basically you're reminding us of, sometimes they go by different names. And persons shouldn't be upset or caught off guard.
No,
they're the same books.
It's just a matter to study the particular translation you have so that you can get your bearings.
And basically, again, we're saying there are seven books that are accepted as inspired books in the scriptures in the old. We're talking about the Old Testament. And plus parts of Esther and Daniel, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go on.
Well, the Catholic Old Testament of 46 books follows the Alexandrian canon, named after Alexandria, Egypt, of the Septuagint, the Old Testament that was translated into Greek around 250 BC by 70 Jewish scholars, and it gets its name from that. At least that's the tradition. We're not sure whether that really happened that way or not, but that's the tradition.
But that's where they get the word Septuagint 70.
Yes, 70.
Supposedly traced back to 70 scholars. But that's just really a kind of a story.
Yes.
Okay.
Ample evidence exists to prove that the apostles and early Christians used the Septuagint. St. Jerome's Latin Vulgate. For many centuries, the official Catholic Bible includes the same books as the Septuagint. Although he translated the Old Testament not from Greek, but rather from Hebrew and Aramaic text.
Well, see, if I could just interpose a moment here, Ron, it's good to remind all of ourselves that most of us, except we're exceptional scholars, are reading a translation of the Bible. That the Old Testament was written in Hebrew and the New Testament was written in Greek. And that's why the church has always been very concerned that we get an accurate translation of the Bible, because most of us don't know any Hebrew and most of us don't know any Greek. So the church is trying to guide us in helping us know what translations are approved and which are not. Okay?
Yes.
Well, now, excuse me.
Well, whether this story is entirely true, as we said, or accurate, it's not known, but it is natural that after a while, some men at least, would have undertaken to compile a Greek translation of the Septuagint, because most of the Jewish people at that time who were scattered about the Roman Empire spoke Greek and read Greek. Most of them had forgotten the Hebrew language.
The Hebrews were, or the Jewish people were dispersed throughout the
yes.
empire. Greek became almost their native tongue.
So it was logical that the Bible be translated, at least the Old Testament, into Greek. It was called Koine Greek. It was the Greek that was spoken by, the common people rather than the classical Greek that you might find literature and things like that and philosophy had been written in. There is no historical record of who performed the translation and when they did so, and I understand that an examination of the text shows that in general the authors were not Palestinian Jews called to Egypt as the tradition would have it, and that differences of terminology, method, etc. clearly prove different persons translated the different books over some period of time. Well, whatever the case, most biblical scholars believe that the Septuagint is a reliable translation from the original Hebrew, and in addition to the Alexandrian Jews, many Greek-speaking pagans obtained knowledge of divine revelation from the Septuagint.
So we're talking about the translation somewhere around before Christ, about 250 before Christ, and we're just talking about the Old Testament.
But it probably wasn't completed until maybe around the year 100. In other words, this
B.C.?
This translation was something that took many centuries. First they translated the Torah, or what's called the Pentateuch, the first five books of the
Genesis,
Bible.
Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy.
Right. And then they gradually began to translate the other books until finally the whole Old Testament got translated from the original Hebrew or a few written in Aramaic into Greek.
Okay, so now the church, Jesus hasn't come on the scene yet and the church doesn't exist, so we're relying on the translations of our Jewish brothers who got it translated somehow into Greek for their people.
Well, as I started to say a while ago, the Greek-speaking pagans, they obtained knowledge of divine revelation from the Septuagint. That was the Old Testament Bible that was circulating at the time the time Jesus came into the world during the time of the Incarnation, and so this kind of prepared the Jewish people for the preaching of the gospel when the time came. the apostles and other early Christian missionaries, they made use of the Septuagint in their preaching and writing.
Okay, so they accepted this translation from the Hebrew into Greek by supposedly 70 scholars, and the apostles and their followers were using this Hebrew translation into Greek in their quotes and their preaching, teaching.
Well, if you, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, I understand that, I think it was Eusebius tells us, and I think Papias, he is quoting Papias, if I recall right, tells us that that Matthew wrote his gospel originally in probably Aramaic, but it wouldn't have been too long that it would have been translated in Greek. But Mark and Luke and John later on, they wrote the manuscript. They wrote the first edition in Greek.
Okay.
And so obviously they're quoting from also a Greek Old Testament in the books that they were actually writing in Greek.
And that's what we call the Septuagint.
Septuagint.
And also Matthew wrote in Greek, wrote in Hebrew or Aramaic because he was writing specifically to the Jewish people. That's why he used the language in the beginning.
And you can tell he's writing to the Jewish people because he doesn't explain a lot of things that ordinarily, if you were writing for a Gentile or a non-Jewish audience, he doesn't explain various rituals and various
feast days
and things of that sort. And another thing, he also has a lot of prophecies in there, prophecies of the Messiah in the Old Testament.
That only the Jewish people would know about.
Only they'd know about, because, you know, Gentiles wouldn't know about these, so you wouldn't put a lot of these prophecies into a book like Mark or Luke so much, or written for Gentiles. And that also, he placed a lot of emphasis upon Jesus Christ being the fulfillment of these prophecies.
Okay. And if I could just add, our listeners who may not be fully acquainted with those two terms, the Jews and the Gentiles, the Jewish people were God's chosen people, beginning with Abraham, and the Gentiles were considered anybody among the nations who wasn't Jewish. So it was just the two big divisions that the Jewish people made, Jews and Gentiles. And then gradually Paul brings the gospel to the Gentiles. Okay, so what else would you like to say about the Septuagint, if anything else, or do you want to go on to something else?
Well, we talked a little bit more about the Septuagint the last session, so I think we probably could go on with something else now.
Okay, well, so just a little quick summary there, because it's the one question I was inevitably asked as a parish priest. What is the main difference between the Protestant and Catholic Bible? There are seven more books in the Catholic Bible that we consider to be inspired. Many Protestants will put them in their Bibles, but they have trouble with knowing if they're inspired or not.
Yeah, they'll usually put them in the back in what's called an Apocrypha.
Okay.
For example, if I recall right, the first King James Version in 1611, these seven books were included in the back in what was called the Apocrypha. But the Catholics, we call those the deuterocanonical books, in other words, the second canon. We consider them to be canonical, or that is, inspired by the Holy Spirit.
Okay, so as Catholics, from the beginning of the Church was St. Peter, who will be visiting us very soon, the successor of Peter, Benedict XVI, and we've always considered these books, the deuterocanonical, which we call them, or the Apocrypha, which the good Protestants call them. We've always inspired them to be the whole Bible and inspired, and that several councils haven't even decided that, particularly the Council of Trent.
We Catholics have a different meaning for Apocrypha. When we had our series on the Da Vinci Code, we spent probably about three or four sessions dealing with the various Apocrypha, since Dan Brown, of course, in the Da Vinci Code is dealing with some of these too. These are books that we would consider to be, for the most part, heretical. They were books that were written by various heretics of the time.
And they're available today.
Oh, yes.
And if you want to, anybody wants to read them,
sure.
All they have to do is read them, and they are so exaggerated and strange statements about Jesus and about his teachings that most any Christian would say, this really sounds crazy, and that's why the church did not introduce, not bring them into the whole Bible.
Most of the heretics were Gnostics, like the Valentinians and the Basilidians and the Marcions and those different kinds of groups that we did talk about.
And say this one word, because we talk much about the Gnostics. What is a Gnostic? An elitist, person who thinks that only the educated can understand.
Well, the idea of Gnosticism comes from, the Gnosis is Greek for know, or knowing, and so it's a secret knowledge that only some people or some sort of an elect possess.
Even St. Augustine got into it under Manichaeism, that special knowledge for reserved for those who have the intelligence and the ability to understand these secret doctrines. Ron, let's talk a minute about, I've heard it said that other versions, the older the version of the Bible, the more likely it is to be accurate. What you want to comment on that? Because we're talking about how the church has always protected the translations of the Bible that we ordinarily people use. And this this is some of the history about where they got these translations and when they were written and what text we got them from.
Well, it'd be nice if we could go all the way back to the actual manuscripts, the handwritten documents of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and St. Paul or whatever, but of course that's not possible. But it is necessary that we get back as close as we can to the very earliest copies of these. And because you see, if you allow for very much time, a lot of times copyist errors will creep in before you know it, or sometimes some people will start filling in their own little details that are not
little devotion.
Yes, right.
Well, the great example of that, I think, is the Our Father, that seemed to have been a little written note on the side of the text by one of the monks, "For thine is the kingdom, mm-hmm. the power, and the glory forever," in the New Testament. And most scholars today would say that was a little written insert, a pious meditation.
A lot of times these are well-meaning, but of course they're not the way things really are, and so we really want to have what Jesus really did say and not somebody's.
And that's why we have in Mass, we have, "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever," but we have it after a little break in the Our Father.
Yes. Well, to get back to your question, in regard to the Old Testament, the three best manuscripts of the Septuagint known are the Vatican Codex Vaticanus. That's a 4th century copy. It goes back to the 300s. There's one called the Alexandrian Codex Alexandrinus, that goes back to the 5th century or the 400s. It's now in the British Museum in London. And then there's one in the Sinai Codex, Sinaiticus, 4th century. It was founded by a famous anthropologist by the name of Tischendorf. He was a German. He found this at the Convent of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai. I saw a pretty good program not too long ago on television about St. Catherine's Monastery.
That's a real ancient monastery.
Mm-hmm.
Is it an Orthodox monastery?
I've forgotten now.
I've forgotten too.
Yeah. I think it's one of the Eastern Rites,
okay.
But I'm not sure whether it's
joined to Rome or not.
Joined to Rome or not.
Okay.
But Tischendorf found this back in 1844 and 1849, during that period of time. It's now in, part of it at least, is in Leipzig in Germany, and part of it's in St. Petersburg in Russia. Of course, these versions of the Bible also contain the New Testament books as well, not just simply the Old Testament books, but the New Testament books. I understand that the Codex Vaticanus is the most accurate of the three because it's based on the most ancient Hebrew text, whereas the Codex Alexandrinus borrows a lot from Origen's Hexaplar text and the Hebrew Masoretic text. Origen's Hexapla. We're going to talk about Origen later on, so I don't want to get too much into him right now.
A great early writer of the church.
Yes, he was one of the early church fathers, called the Hexapla. And what he did with this, he placed side by side six versions of the Old Testament, including the second century Greek translations of Aquila and Sinope. The Masoretic text is the Hebrew text of the Jewish Bible, sometimes called the Tanakh. And it was primarily copied, edited, and distributed by a group of Jews known as the Masoretes, between the 7th and 10th centuries A.D.
And, now, what you're explaining to us now is what scripture scholars continually study. The church asks its scholars to keep the magisterium informed, and so the church is always in contact with the best copies that we have. But again, without the church, we wouldn't, these translations that we're reading, we wouldn't know whether they're valid or not.
That's right. In regard to the New Testament, compared with other existing ancient documents, we possess a large number of manuscripts and fragments of manuscripts of the New Testament that were written very close to the time of the original documents. In fact, I understand that we have as many as 5,000 of these. They're not, it may just be a book, it might be a whole a book of the Bible, or it could be just maybe a chapter, or it could just be fragments, but I understand there's over 5,000 of these very, very old fragments that go back maybe to the second century, even the second, third century. The existing manuscripts of most ancient classical stories were written many centuries after the original compositions. In other words, these are ancient writings other than the Bible. And take Homer, for example. Any copies that we have of Homer were written, that we have today, were written hundreds, many hundreds of years after Homer actually wrote the original.
In Greek.
But on the other hand, the Bible, we have copies that don't go back, as I said, to manuscript copies that were actually written by the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or St. Paul, but we do have copies that go back to the fragments, at least, that go back to the second, the third, and the fourth centuries.
Now, let me ask you this question right here. You know, some people say, oh, well, the truths of the Bible were lost, they were mistranslated down through the centuries, and so we don't really know for sure what are the real inspired texts of the gospel since we've lost the original copies. How would you answer that?
Well, contrary to that statement that some people have made, of course, scholars claim that the New Testament that we possess today is over 99% free of textual discrepancies, putting no major Christian doctrines in doubt.
Okay.
In other words, yeah, there have been a few copyist errors that have come in over the years, and there's been some editing, some people have added some little comments and what have you. So that's why it's important to get back to the earliest copies we can and eliminate to correct any errors that, you know, is found in some of these later manuscripts.
Sure.
Well, in other words, a comparison with the current New Testament with the oldest available manuscripts shows few textual discrepancies, proving that very few copyist or editorial errors exist in these modern editions that we have today. And the criteria used by the early church to determine which documents should be considered inspired by the Holy Spirit and free from doctrinal error have ensured that we possess the most accurate records about Jesus that's possible.
Would you agree or not that almost all Protestant and Catholic scholars would agree on the translations of the scriptures today, and the main problem what we have is the interpretation, but not the translations, because they're pretty, scholars have, as you said, maybe given us 99% texts that are genuine.
I think there's pretty much agreement between Catholic and Protestant scholars on that matter.
We've only got a few minutes. Maybe we could take why the Septuagint, this book supposedly translated from Hebrew into Greek by 70 scholars. That's why it's called the Septuagint, 70 in Greek. was important to us as Catholics?
Well, the Septuagint version of, the version of the Bible is important to us for several reasons. First, the Septuagint is the most ancient translation of the Old Testament available, and consequently is available to biblical scholars for understanding and correcting the Hebrew text. Scholars tell us that many errors, such as textual corruptions, additions, and omissions, must have crept into the Hebrew text between the 3rd and 2nd centuries B.C. and the 6th and 7th centuries A.D. So therefore, the manuscripts used by the Septuagint translators might have been better than the later Hebrew Masoretic manuscripts. In other words, what I'm saying here is that versions that the Jewish people may be used today are not as accurate as the Septuagint.
Because it's so ancient.
Because it used more ancient copies of the Old Testament to make its translation.
All right, the second point, I think, is particularly important to us as Catholics for the spread of the gospel.
Yes, the second reason is that it is so important is that its acceptance by the Alexandrian Jews and then other Greek-speaking countries helped to spread the expectation of the Messiah among the Gentiles. Also, then it introduced to the Greek-speaking world the theological terminology that made it most suitable instrument for the propagation of the gospel of Christ when the time came. Another reason for this importance of the Septuagint is that the Jews recognized it long before the Christian era, and so during Christ's time it was recognized as a legitimate text. In fact, it was the text that Jesus himself would have used. Even the Jewish rabbis of Palestine came to use the Septuagint in time. In other words, it was not only used by Jews outside of Palestine, but the Palestinian Jews started using it after a while. So it was natural that the apostles and evangelists used it and borrowed Old Testament citations from it, especially in regard to the prophecies. Moreover, the church fathers and the other ecclesiastical writers of the other church drew upon it. Early Christians held the Septuagint in high esteem, and some even believed it to be inspired. And then there's one final reason why the Septuagint is so important to us, is the official text in the Greek church and the ancient Latin versions used in the Western church were made from it, such as the Italia. In other words, let me repeat that. A lot of the early liturgies came from the Septuagint. Even the names of the books of the Pentateuch and other Old Testament books derived from the Septuagint, such as the names, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Hebrew versions named these books after the first word in the text, sort of like popes, their encyclicals. A lot of times, you know, they get their name from the first two or three words in Latin.
Right. Go ahead, we got about 30 seconds.
Well, Saint Jerome used the names of the books found in the Septuagint in his Latin Vulgate translation, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy.
Okay, well, we're going to phase out. May God bless you always and in always.
Beside restful waters, he refreshes my soul. His love and his mercy have washed, made me whole. As I give